This is the second side of the interview with Larry Finkelstein, so we'll continue.
Okay. The other major issue was the whole issue of non-self-governing territories and trusteeship, because
right.
that had not been incorporated in the Dumbarton Oaks.
Yes, that was one of the questions I wanted to ask you, whether or not that had been settled ahead of time. Was it discussed at Yalta, though?
Yes, it was discussed at Yalta to the extent of getting an agreement that this could be an issue to be dealt with at the San Francisco
conference. Okay, but the issues themselves weren't settled there.
Absolutely, and I can tell you a little bit about that. It's interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
But what happened at Yalta was an agreement that the San Francisco conference might address general principles of the post-war colonial order,
mm-hmm.
and might consider establishing a trusteeship system.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe the language adopted there was very close to the language which found its way into the charter with respect to trusteeship, namely that such a trusteeship system might affect territories. This is Article 77 of the charter,
mm-hmm.
territories which had been held under mandate under the League of Nations system, territories which might be taken away from enemy states as a result of the Second World War,
right.
and territories which might voluntarily be placed under the system
mm-hmm.
by the colonial powers.
Right. Okay.
But basically, the agreement at Yalta was that no specific colonial issues were to be dealt with in the conference, just the framework for an international system
for dealing with it at a later time. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And that agreement was pretty well adhered to in the San Francisco conference.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that the U.S. delegation led in this respect by Governor Stassen did was to defend that principle against attempts by others to introduce specific colonial issues of contention.
Mm-hmm.
Those initiatives were taken, but they were all defeated
mm-hmm.
and contained. But the thing I wanted to emphasize, which I think is fascinating,
mm-hmm.
is that the reason the colonial agenda was not as far advanced by the time the San Francisco conference began, as were most of the other issues in the charter,
mm-hmm.
was that there had been a deep split in the U.S. government on this issue.
All right.
Going back to for years,
mm-hmm.
but emerging sharply in the late spring of 1944 as planning for the Dumbarton Oaks conversations was moving into an advanced stage.
Yeah.
And there had been a lot of preparation in the State Department of drafts for a trusteeship plan and a declaration having to do with the principles of colonial government.
Mm-hmm.
And there had been some consultations with the British. And most thought that this plan was ready to proceed, but it was the military services which threw a monkey wrench into the works for two reasons. First, they were very concerned that these questions would involve territorial issues which might open up disputes among the countries still conducting the war against the Axis. Remember,
mm-hmm.
I'm talking about 1944.
Mm-hmm. Right, because it was still underway.
And so their main argument was that they didn't want to introduce any unnecessarily contentious issues that might cause splits between us and particularly the Russians.
Mm-hmm. Well,
the second issue was the belief, particularly of the Navy, that it had to have the islands which we were winning island by island from the Japanese,
mm-hmm.
Some of which had been under the League of Nations mandate after World War I, but others which had not. And so the Navy was against any concept of trusteeship which might internationalize those islands and thus deprive the Navy of the benefit of U.S. sovereignty over them.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And on this, they were clearly opposed by the President himself,
mm-hmm.
But somehow or other the Navy managed to keep the issue alive,
yeah.
and it persisted in the internal debates in Washington right up to the eve of the San Francisco conference,
mm-hmm.
and indeed was settled only by a late-hour decision perhaps the last one President Roosevelt reached before he died in Warm Springs. And the final shape of the U.S. proposals did not appear until a working group on the train going from the East Coast to San Francisco on the way to the conference reworked the proposals and came up with the draft which the United States introduced at the conference. So it was really a Perils of Pauline.
But during the conference in San Francisco itself, then there was not disagreement amongst the American delegation on that issue? It had become settled?
No, by the time the conference began, there was a U.S. position, which by and large was accepted by the delegation. But, you know, we started out this conversation, this line of thought, dealing with the importance of individual words and discussions. Precise language. One of those arose in this context, namely the question whether independence should be stated as a goal of the administration of colonies and or the trusteeship territory. And that did split the American delegation because, for reasons that have never been entirely clear to me, Governor Stassen believed it was necessary to avoid the establishment of independence as the goal for territories under colonial rule. I think he believed it was that doing that was a condition of getting approval by the colonial powers of the charter provisions dealing with colonial issues. And so he brandished the club in behalf of softer language. And indeed, there's one incident. I was not present, obviously, but I was told later by somebody who was that on the way to the meeting in the automobile, his advisors urged Governor Stassen not to take the initiative in defending the British position opposing the word independence. He ignored their advice and made a very powerful and effective speech against including the word independence. That got very negative headlines in the national press and indeed around the world, because here you had the representative of the great champion of colonial independence. That had been an important theme for Franklin Delano Roosevelt, for example. Itself a former colony founded in the War of Revolution against the colonial regime. You had the representative of this country standing up and opposing independence. And professionally, many thought it hadn't been necessary because the British were perfectly capable of defending their own case on that. And it's a bit of a mystery to me why he should have done that. But in any case, the language, a kind of a compromise agreement was reached under which the word independence was included as an objective with respect to those trust territories, which were to have a special international status to promote their progressive development towards self-government or independence, as may be appropriate to the particular circumstances of each territory and its peoples, and the freely expressed wishes of the peoples concerned. But it was not included in that part of the charter devoted to all other colonies, which were by far the most numerous. And there the language is to develop self-government. This is Article 73B of the Charter. To develop self-government, to take due account of the political aspirations of the peoples, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, carefully avoiding the word independence as such. And so here's another case where the language agreed upon was strongly debated, because the language represented conflicting views as to what the purpose should be.
And also the use of the term self-governing. How was that interpreted? Because certainly not all of the nations involved at that time were democracies. So were there various interpretations of
I don't think it had anything to do with the form of government within a country. I think it had to do with the conduct of affairs autonomously from the colonial power. It's funny, you know, I've written about this in something that hasn't been published, but the Americans thought that they were advocating self-determination.
Right, yeah, yeah.
When they were proposing a trusteeship plan, which was to provide guidance and oversight, rather than self-determination. Self-determination is an act of deciding.
Yeah, yeah.
And
for
the trusteeship system didn't provide for such autonomous decision of the peoples of the trust territories that they could be independent of or whatever course they chose of the previous administering powers. So I think there was some intellectual confusion in the American position. They confused the trusteeship with self-determination. And when they spoke of developing self-government, the language which got into Article 73 of the Charter, I think they conceived of that as akin to the notion of self-determination, the right of people
The language
to
is very
adopt
close.
Their own laws
yeah.
rather than have the colonial power adopt the law.
Yeah, okay. All right, so in that sense, there it could have been a compromise of language there.
Well, there was. They put the word independence in one part and not in the other.
And not in
and
the
that's
other part.
The compromise they
and self-governing
consciously reached.
Maybe a softer term than self-determination.
Although it was interpreted by Stassen and others as broad enough to incorporate independence. It didn't exclude independence from self-government. Might come to mean independent. Clearly they shied away from putting so hard-edged a word in that part of the Charter because of the resistance of the colonial powers to doing that.
Right, right, yeah. Well, okay, that is really very interesting, and it's fine to go off in those areas because those are areas I wanted to cover anyway. I just wanted to come back again to a little bit more of the structure of the conference itself. We talked about the fact that there was a controversy about Argentina's participation in the conference, but then later on they were accepted. How was it decided as to who would represent Poland at the conference?
Oh, Lord. I'm not sure my memory is going to enable me to answer that question.
No.
One thing that happened, which had a tremendous negative impact in San Francisco, was that the Russians... Well, let's back up a bit. There had been two ostensible governments of Poland during the war.
Right.
One was the government of exiles in London.
Right.
Which had dealt with the Brits and the Dutch, and which we acknowledge to be the government of Poland. There was also the so-called Lublin government,
right.
which was a government of communists, which was supported by the Soviet Union. And the Russians had agreed that the London group should go to Moscow there to meet with the Lublin group to negotiate an agreement as to the government of Poland. And when the London group arrived in Moscow, the Russians arrested them and clapped them in jail. A clear act of infamy and malfeasance. And this burst open the San Francisco conference like a thunderclap, as you can imagine, because it was the clearest... the Russians were very difficult to get along with in many respects in that conference, from the first minutes.
Yeah.
But this was a clear evidence that the harmony that the UN scheme required among the great powers did not exist, and that you had what later came to be called the Cold War in progress.
Right.
And it really was regarded as a dirty blow, and one which challenged the authenticity of the Soviet claim to want to be a partner in this organization which was being designed at San Francisco. And I'm sorry, I just can't recall what the resolution of that Polish question was. What delegation should be seated in the conference? you'll have to let me pass on that.
But in it, there.
I have a feeling that maybe there was a vacant seat that Poland was considered a member, but no delegation was accredited.
Yeah. But just talking about your mentioning the anxieties about the possibility that the Soviet Union would not ultimately cooperate with the United Nations. In general, what was the atmosphere, though, in San Francisco in terms of optimism for the United Nations?
Very mixed. You know, to give you just an example, which is really not in and of itself an extremely important one, but nevertheless indicative of the mood, when international conferences had been convened, the norm had been that the chairmanship should, or the presidency should be held by the host country. Mm-hmm. And the Russians weren't having any of that at San Francisco. And they made an issue of it in the early hours of the conference. Mm-hmm. I mean, that had been the plan, that as the host, the United States would have the chairmanship. Mm-hmm. And they contested that, and thus, out of that, resulted the kind of awkward rotating for power chairmanship that actually was adopted for the conference. Not a matter of great substance, but an indication of how unwilling the Russians were to play the game as the Western powers thought it ought to be played. And they were obstreperous and difficult up and down the line, very determined to assert their own interests and defend them vigorously. But as I said before, they, like the others in the group of five, were very cautious about disrupting the consensus that had been reached among the five when it was under attack by the 45, 46 others present at San Francisco. And by and large, they did succeed in preserving a united front. And in cases like the trusteeship issue, where the position had not been created before the conference, they were reasonably successful in coming to agreement and then defending it against external assault.
So there was cooperation there.
But it was necessary. You see, this was pragmatic self-interest. They were real tough when it came to arriving at that agreement among the five. But once agreement among the five existed, they were pretty good about helping to defend it. The critical issue, I mean, the more direct answer to your question about optimism, the critical issue in the conference itself had to do with the veto. And there should be no misunderstanding about this. The United States was just as firmly needing a veto in the Security Council, as were the Russians.
Now, wasn't this agreed upon before arriving in San Francisco?
That principle was well established. They agreed at Dumbarton Oaks. Well, they left it unsettled at Dumbarton Oaks because some dimension, some aspects of this, there was not agreement on, but they had reached an agreement at the altar. And basically, the principle that there should be a veto was settled. The United States needed it because nobody believed that the United States Senate would give its advice and consent to ratification of the Charter in the absence of a veto for the United States to prevent a majority acting against the United States or deciding that the United States should be committed to enforcement action anywhere in the world when the United States didn't wish to do that. So the veto was vital for the U.S. as well. So the question was not whether there should be a veto, but how far down in the process of decision-making the veto should apply. And here, the United States wanted to avoid the application of the veto to decisions that an issue should be discussed. And the Russians were arguing that the decision to discuss should be subject to the veto as well.
And Molotov was very outspoken on that.
That's right. Molotov was outspoken. And this was a division, this was an issue that divided the Big Five and also involved a great deal of, minimally speaking, curiosity and real anger among the 46 others who resented the notion of the veto to begin with, who knew that they were going to have to swallow it because there would be no charter without it, and they couldn't afford not to have the charter. So they were in the position of being run roughshod over by the Big Five anyway.
Mm-hmm.
They were mad as hell about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that included a lot of Latin Americans. It included, in the leadership of this resistance, was Herbert Evett of Australia,
right. Of
Peter
Australia.
Fraser
okay.
of New Zealand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This was not just a north-south issue.
Mm-hmm.
It was
mm-hmm.
a small country, big country issue. Even the Canadians were on that.
Uh-huh.
So
And this resistance was a resistance to the major power veto in general, or to the veto on the discussion, or both?
They wanted to cut back the veto in any way they
could.
In any way they could, okay. That oversimplifies and overgeneralizes,
mm-hmm.
but basically that was the position they were in. And therefore, on this particular issue, of course, they were for the softer U.S. view that there could be discussion about
mm-hmm.
That issue was that issue was solved in two different ways. One was that when President Truman sent Harry Hopkins to Moscow sometime in May, he got Stalin to overrule Molotov. And
right.
Stalin thus agreed with the U.S. interpretation of how far
uh-huh, uh-huh.
the veto power should extend in the Charter.
Right.
And so that resolved the U.S.
Okay, so Stalin
issue.
Overruled
at
Molotov.
At this point, you had a five-power agreement.
Mm-hmm.
But then you had the five powers with a big wall and stakes and spears sticking out defending,
mm-hmm.
and shields defending themselves against the assault from the hordes of you know, mm-hmm. smaller countries outside wishing to batter down the protection of the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was that the five powers consulted with each other and arrived at what ended up being a very tough statement, which they presented to the rest of the countries as their interpretation of the extent to which there would be a veto. And the theory underlying this tough agreement of the five, which they defended and imposed upon, defended against the others, and really
mm-hmm.
imposed upon them in the end, because
mm-hmm.
The latter had no choice.
No.
The theory behind this is an interesting concept called the chain of events theory.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're interested in following up on it, you'll find very full expositions by Leo Pasvolsky.
Oh, all right.
In the minutes of the American delegation, published
okay.
in a volume of Foreign Relations of the United States for 1945.
Okay.
There's a volume of that
okay.
official document series
uh-huh.
for the conference, and in that there are the minutes of the U.S. delegation, and buried in those minutes is Leo Pasvolsky's exposition,
okay.
very Jesuitical exposition of this chain of events theory.
Yeah, that's very good, because for people doing further research, it's really helpful to have that kind of...
And Ruth Russell has written about this, and I've
mm-hmm.
written about it here.
Mm-hmm.
The chain of events theory was really simple and quite simple-minded. It was that it was appropriate for the great powers to insist that the veto extend quite deeply into the processes
mm-hmm.
of Security Council decision. Because once an item was on the agenda, there could ensue a, quote, chain of events, close quote, which could lead to the invocation of those threats to the interests of the great powers, which the veto was designed to protect. Therefore, the veto ought to be available earlier in the process to head off to prevent such a chain of events from developing,
yeah.
threatening the autonomy of the great powers.
Mm-hmm.
That has been criticized because the Charter itself draws a very clear distinction between its peaceful settlement procedures in
mm-hmm.
Chapter 6 and
mm-hmm.
the powers of the Security Council to take enforcement actions under Chapter 7.
Mm-hmm.
And that line of demarcation is clear enough so that many have argued that there is no chain of events.
Yeah.
That was a phony
rationale. Yeah.
But... I've always thought that Pasvolsky understood that the Russians had the habit that, although we were somewhat looser as to just where in the procedure a veto must apply, mm-hmm. we could probably live with the protection of the enforcement powers part of the Charter, that he had to defend a deeper extension of the veto because it was necessary from a Russian point of view, and he wanted to be sure the Russians did not have reason to bump the arm.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's how it came out, that although there can be no veto of a discussion mm-hmm. as such, or of a decision to put an item on the agenda of the Security Council.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, the veto is pretty pervasive,
mm-hmm.
and that statement of the five powers, which I referred to, that they imposed upon the rest of the continent, also included the so-called double veto, mm-hmm. namely that if there were dispute as to whether the veto should apply or not, that decision would itself be subject to veto.
Was there disagreement amongst the American delegation on the issue of the veto?
There was considerable. Harold Stassen, for example, and others were among those who, nobody challenged that there must be a veto. That was accepted by everybody.
Yeah.
But there were disagreements in the delegation about how far they should go.
Mm-hmm.
And you, on the two congressmen, Eaton and Bloom, really didn't matter very much. There was, they were not powerful figures in that delegation.
Mm-hmm.
But the two senators were of critical importance.
Mm-hmm.
And so you often had a kind of a liberal-conservative division mm-hmm. between Stassen and Dean Gildersleeve on the one hand,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and the two senators representing the conservative side on the other.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you a story.
Okay.
Which is, it's a wonderful anecdote.
Yeah.
My duties kept me pretty busy most of the time, and I didn't get to see many meetings of the conference.
Mm-hmm.
But I did make an effort to be there on the occasion when Senator Connally, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, whose vote and leadership were going to be critical to the decision whether or not the United States was going to join the United Nations.
Uh-huh. So he was a fairly influential, powerful person.
Oh, yes, yeah. Because he was expected, he and Vandenberg between them were expected mm-hmm. to control the Senate Foreign Relations Committee,
uh-huh.
which was going to be the body to vote on whether or not the Senate should be asked to give advice and consent.
Right, okay.
To the charter.
Yeah.
We've come lately to talk about the two-level game of international diplomacy, mm-hmm. the international negotiation, and then the domestic
mm-hmm.
negotiation that's linked. It was
right,
operative
right.
in
it was,
that delegation.
It was already there, yeah.
Well, anyway, Connally was sent in behalf of the U.S. delegation to read the law, the Riot Act, to the other small countries on the question of the veto.
Mm-hmm.
And he was sent deliberately because of this, because everybody understood that he would control whether or not there could
okay.
be a,
yeah.
a Senate approval.
Yeah.
And he was, in any case, a large, imposing man,
uh-huh.
very memorable character. He always wore a black string tie, and he had a 20-gallon tack. Pat, he was a Texan.
Yeah, yeah.
Black coat,
uh-huh.
Sort of a preacher's black coat. He was marvelous. and he played it up, you know, he built up this persona.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was a 4th of July orator, a stump orator with mm-hmm. rotund, mm-hmm. orotund rhetoric, and he had a lot of fun and something. So there he was. He went down to this committee 3-3
uh-huh.
to tell them that, you know, if you don't lay off on this veto, you're not going to have a charter. You're going to go home without it.
Yeah.
And there are two funny things. The place next to the U.S. place was occupied by the British, the U.K., United States, next to each other in the alphabetical order around the table.
Yeah.
And the British on this occasion were represented by a mild-mannered, very distinguished British professor of history, later became Sir Charles Webster.
Right, yeah.
And okay. there was old Connally waving his arms as he spoke, as though we were addressing 50,000 people down there in Austin, Texas, you see,
yeah.
on the 4th of July. And I watched as poor old Charles Webster slunk lower and lower and lower to avoid having his head knocked off
by the swinging arm. Yeah.
And finally, you could barely see the top of his head over the table. But the other anecdote is even funnier.
Hold on, because I think we're real close to the end, and I don't want to interrupt.